Funding for THINK comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to THINK on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it possible to create a world where everyone gets a fair share of what they need? Competition for finite resources is an age-old element of human history, as is the reality that most societies end up divided between the haves and the have-nots. But my guest today reminds us that the drive to compromise and collaborate has at least as much evolutionary importance as the urge to look out for number one, and that the cooperative side of our nature has the power to transform the modern world if we are willing to put it to use. Peter Corning is director of the Institute for the Study of Complex Systems and a former writer for Newsweek magazine. His new book is called The Fair Society, The Science of Human Nature and the Pursuit of Social Justice. Peter, welcome to THINK.
Well, thank you very much. And that was a very good introduction.
Thank you very much. We'll start with this. How do you define a fair society?
Well, we sort of have to back up a little bit and talk first about how to define fairness.
Okay.
I think this, the broadest, most generic way of defining it is simply that it requires taking into account and trying to balance or compromise among the many differing, sometimes often conflicting, interests and stakes that the stakeholders have in any kind of group, whether it's a small community or a large society. Fairness, by implication, requires compromises between the various individual interests we have, taking into account what others' needs are as well as our own. So from that perspective, the next step in trying to fill in the picture here is the recognition that a sense of fairness, this sense of concern and willingness to accommodate to others' needs and interests is increasingly evident, is an innate human trait. It is a product of our evolution as a species over millions of years, when we evolved in close, tight-knit, interdependent groups and had to depend on one another for survival, and that fairness was a lubricant, a facilitator that enabled these groups to get along and to cooperate together. And that's not to say that we all have an equal sense of fairness or that that's our overriding concern, but it is a predisposition that most of us share. There are always outliers, and some maybe 25 or 30% of the population, according to the research that has developed on this, that are more or less fairness challenged, but most of us, most of the time, do have a sense of fairness that we bring into play, although it can be overridden by our sense of self-interest as well as cultural and forces and influences and the people around us. So it's a labile trait. It's not a cookie cutter kind of human trait, but it is a predisposition, kind of like our ability to learn languages. That's a predisposition. We learn it naturally. We don't have to be taught language. Children pick it up because they have a predisposition to learn it, and it's very similar with our sense of fairness. So to get to your question, how then does fairness apply to a complex society like our own? And the answer is that there really are three different precepts or principles of fairness that have to be kind of put together and balanced to make a fair society. The most important and most fundamental has to do with the fact that we are all equal with respect to our basic survival and reproductive needs. They're biological imperatives that we all have. And we share them in common. And to the extent that those needs are not met, that means that we are suffering harm or possibly death. And others in our society may, in one way or another, be be causing that harm by depriving people of their basic needs. So this imposes an obligation upon all of us collectively to provide for the basic needs of our population. That's a right we all share. But that doesn't deny the fact that merit or just deserts is also a very important principle of fairness. And so beyond whatever is required in any society to provide for the basic needs of the population, there should be rewards that are in proportion to people's efforts and achievements and their skills and abilities. So it's not a question of either or, but of balancing the two. But then there's a third principle that is equally important and in a sense closes the loop or balances the scale in terms of fairness, and that's the principle of reciprocity. That is also a deeply ingrained human trait. If society provides all kinds of benefits for people, then in order to support those benefits, we all have an obligation to share proportionately in providing for the costs, so that we don't have a society of free riders. We have a society who are contributing in proportion to the benefits they receive from society. So those three principles are absolutely essential and really have to be tied together in order to achieve a fair society.
Well, it would seem like in some ways this principle of reciprocity is the one that is most challenging, particularly for those people that you called fairness challenged, because there are people who are very prosperous who feel as if their prosperity is solely the product of their own hard work, and they don't necessarily look around and recognize that they sort of came into the world with a set of benefits that others might not enjoy.
Yeah, that's very true. That ideology is out there, and it's very self-serving, and it's not accurate. There is a wonderful book by Malcolm Gladwell called Outliers, in which he definitively rebuts that argument by showing that in fact success, and he uses many examples, Bill Gates being one of the most prominent ones, Bill Joy, who was another computer pioneer, Steve Jobs at Apple, three of our most illustrious high-tech billionaires, all represented examples of people who were fortunate enough to be at the right place at the right time, had advantages that others didn't have, and an element of luck, as well as being having the support of the family and the educational system and people around them who served as mentors and facilitated their taking advantage of the opportunities that were available. I mean, for example, Bill Gates had among the earliest computers. His private school bought a bunch of them before they really were out in the marketplace. They were still prototypes. And so he had years of experience using computers before he was even in high school. And so he got a jump start that would not have been possible if he had not gone to that private school. And that's just one little example of the thousands of ways in which we benefit from things that are not necessarily the result of our own talent, skill, and ability. Inherited wealth is another example. The good fortune of being the child of somebody who is wealthy doesn't mean that you deserve that you have earned the money you have.
Mm-hmm. Even the good fortune of being born middle class.
Pardon me?
Even the good fortune of having been born middle class puts people several steps ahead of those who were born into poverty.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, there's been a number of studies of the issue of equal opportunity, and it's very clear that the children of the poor and the working class in our society are severely disadvantaged, and that in terms of being able to rise on the economic ladder. Contrary to the mythology, actually, we are less equal in terms of opportunity than many other industrial societies.
Well, let's talk about that for a minute, because, I mean, we hear all the time that the gap in the United States, the richest country in the world, between rich and poor continues to widen.
Yes.
Why is that happening?
Wow, that is a tough question. There are a lot of reasons why that's happening. Just off the top of my head, part of it is an ideology that extols and allows for the unlimited accumulation of wealth, with the rationale being that if the wealthy get wealthier, if the rich get richer, the benefits will trickle down to the rest of us, so that we will all ultimately benefit from that. The greater good for the greatest number, but in fact the statistics give a lie to that. Just to give you a couple of examples, in 2010 the income for the top 1% of our population was 24%. In other words, about a quarter of the total personal income in the country, and the top 10% had half the total personal income. That means the other 90% of us had to divide up the other half. As for wealth, the top 20% had 87%, 87.2%, I think it was, up from a mere 84% back in 2008. So the trend toward the concentration of wealth at the very top of the pyramid is continuing to get worse in the wake of the economic meltdown and the Great Recession. So it's clear that the system is not benefiting the rest of us. In fact, if you look at some of the statistics at the bottom of the economic ladder, they've been getting significantly worse. There was a study was reported recently showing that high school graduates between 1980 and 2008 saw the median income decline from $44,200 to $32,000, about a 68% decline in the median income for high school graduates. And, of course, during that time, prices doubled. So, in effect, it meant about a 68% decline in the standard of living of high school graduates. That means more than two-thirds, their income currently is about one-third of what it was back in 1980. No wonder that poverty has been spreading in our society, and no wonder that increasingly people are feeling that what's happening for the few at the top is not benefiting the people at the bottom.
My guest is Peter Corning. He's director of the Institute for the Study of Complex Systems and a former Newsweek writer. His new book is called The Fair Society, The Science of Human Nature and the Pursuit of Social Justice. Join our conversation now by calling in. The number is 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Peter Corning. He's director of the Institute for the Study of Complex Systems and the author of the new book, The Fair Society, The Science of Human Nature and the Pursuit of Social Justice. The number to call if you'd like to join the conversation is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. You write here about something called the biosocial contract. Can you tell us what that is, Peter?
Yes. Could I just back up, though, for a second to finish the previous question where I didn't, there was one other piece that where we kind of got cut off.
Sure, sure.
In terms of why it is that we don't, that we have allowed this really unfair society to evolve over the last 20 or 30 years. I think part of it has to do with our perceptions. You know, our statistics, official statistics having to do with things like unemployment, the poverty line, and so forth, really misrepresent the reality. To take one example, inflation, the inflation, official inflation rate excludes fuel and food costs. And those are probably two of the most essential essential needs for most people these days, and yet they aren't counted in the cost of living. And the argument is, well, they're volatile; they go up and down. But in fact, the trend has been over time has been upward. Food prices, the food price index, has doubled since 2000. That's one way in which we, in effect, misrepresent reality. Another is unemployment. The official rate is about 9%, but if you count the people who are not who have never had a job or have stopped looking for work or who are only part-time employed but need full-time employment, it's more like 17% of the population, which is, you know, like 25 million people. Hmm. And so to the extent that our official statistics downplay the actual state of our economy, that lulls us into thinking that things are better than they really are.
Well, and it seems also that the people who are benefiting from the way things are right now are those with the most power to change it.
Exactly. It's the more educated, the people with a stake in the political system, who are the people who get out and vote. Absolutely. And more to the point, spend millions and billions, even, it turns out, in the case of the banks, on lobbying and in other ways influencing public policy, regardless of the way people vote in elections. So this is an important part of the explanation, and there are other parts, too, for why it is that our society now has the dubious reputation, dubious distinction of having the widest gap between the rich and the poor of any industrialized nation, and all of the 30 OECD countries, democratic countries, excluding Turkey and Mexico, we're in the race to the bottom. We're still only third from the bottom, but that's not much of a distinction.
So to this biosocial contract, you're not talking about giving everyone in America a handout for the same group of things. You're talking about making sure everyone can access these things.
Yes, but also making sure that there is what I call a basic needs guarantee, that we provide the means for everybody in society to be able to meet their basic needs. And that's not just a vague abstraction or a vague term. The term basic needs, as I explain in the book, has a generations of research behind it by various agencies, international and American, on what our basic needs are and what is required to satisfy them. And there was a project at our research institute called the Survival Indicators Program, in which we've identified 14 basic needs domains, because those needs have maybe have several components mm-hmm. in some cases, that are required for our continued health and our ability to survive and reproduce the next generation, which is an important consideration. So the getting back to your question, providing for our basic needs is something that is, that ought to be treated as an absolute right. But the most, to me, the most fair-minded way to do that is by providing everybody who is willing and able to work with employment at a living wage, giving them an income that is sufficient to be able to meet their basic needs. And that involves a proposal which is not new. It goes back to the Employment Act of 1946 and was originally going to be included as a mandate, but is now only a wish, a hope expressed in the Employment Act, that we would provide a full employment program for all people who were, you know, able to work.
Mm-hmm.
That would be the most fair-minded, because people would then contribute their fair share of work in return for the benefits that they receive. But it would ensure that all of the basic needs of our population are met. And as I say, those 25 million people out there who can't find work for one reason or another would then be able to have a job. So this, to me, would be a much more efficient way to meet basic needs than to expand unemployment programs or to expand welfare programs.
So the question that always comes about with the living wage is, if you provide that to every worker who is, you know, doing a decent and respectable job, how do you keep the prices of consumer goods and services from rising above what those making what was defined as a living wage earn?
Well, there are a number of ways of doing that or mitigating that. Perhaps the most important, as I mentioned in the book, and I think it has a lot of merit, is that the proposal by the Nobel Prize-winning economist Edmund Phelps at Columbia for a subsidy for employers to help them to pay a living wage to their workers, so that employers would not have to increase their prices. They would get help with being able to raise the wages of their workers, and that would be done by a payroll tax rebate. The idea being that in effect the government through the taxes that it brings in would help to undergird the wages of the, you know, working class, and the fact is that we're already doing it. That is one of the things that is being done this year as a result of the agreement that was worked out by President Obama and the Republicans back in December, I think it was, when the issue of extending the tax cuts for the wealthy came up, and one of the extending unemployment was one of the things that the Democrats achieved in return, and another was this rebate of the payroll tax as a way to assist employers in hiring new workers, and so it was a stimulus for business, small businesses especially. So this is a principle that actually a program that already is being tried, and if something were done in a more systematic, long-term way, this would be, I think, a very effective way to work toward a full employment program.
Let's go to the phones now. The number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll speak first with Hailu in Dallas. Hi, Hailu.
Yes. I got a question. First, I just appreciate the opportunity you gave to me to ask some question. most of us, all human relationships are guided by transference in our adult life or feeling that was powerful in childhood. They tell us in school and in anywhere psychologists touch. Of course, when we turn in each country as each individual intellectuals, they reflect the way they grow up and the way they believe. Now, from my point of view, the gentleman was explaining the top two, the top three. If these rich people giving up their money 20 years from now, that money will not be here. But what is the source of it? What is the differences in our society make differences? Because education, unwanted child, religion on one side, anti-abortion, parental control, they are against that. How many kids are living with welfare? That welfare money, where come from? That kid also after grow up, how we going to take care of the education to have decent job when grow up? We politicians don't want to say something for tomorrow what the country could be better because they don't want to backlash from the public.
Well, Hailey, you put a lot on the table there, and education certainly is something, Peter, that you have written about quite a bit in the book. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Obviously, education is crucially important, and especially in a complex society, a knowledge society like our own. I think we are failing if we do not provide a more equitable educational system. And eliminate some of the barriers. In public schools, we are cutting back on teacher salaries and cutting back on money for education. And in higher education, we are creating greater barriers by the cost of going to college being outpacing the cost of living and graduates going further and further into debt, and that becomes a serious economic liability, carrying perhaps $30,000 or more if you go to graduate school into your years when you're still just starting out and you have very little, relatively little income, and you're at the bottom of the economic ladder. And you're expected to start saving, start having a family, buy a home. All of these things, this kind of indebtedness makes all of these things much more difficult to achieve, especially if you don't come from an affluent family that can subsidize some of these things for you.
So can we afford to send everybody to college who wants to go?
Can we afford? Well, I guess it depends on what the trade-offs are.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, if we spent less on our defense budget, we could afford it. If we imposed a higher tax burden on million-dollar salaries, we could afford more of it. Those are trade-offs we have to make. What things will we sacrifice in order to be able to make education a higher priority? We certainly, as a society, we have the wherewithal to do it. There is a book several years ago called The 2% Solution, in which the author, forget his first name, Miller, argued that that basically with 2% of our annual GDP reallocated to meeting the basic needs of our population, including education and other things, healthcare, that we could satisfy the unmet needs. So it's something that we could do at the margin without having to cut deeply into the meat of our economy.
Let's go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we will speak with Jim in Dallas. Hello, Jim.
Hi, Jim. Hi, my name's Jim. I was wondering, to what degree do you think choice plays into people being in this sort of unfair disadvantaged group? Your guest just spoke about trade-offs. For example, the person who chooses to spend their money on, you know, a computer or an iPhone instead of, you know, the $4 prescription at Walmart, you know? So what degree does choice play into people's inability to get those 13 or 14 basic needs that your guest spoke of?
Yeah, well, I think that's a very good point. Sometimes we don't make the best choices, and choice is certainly an important factor in the outcomes in terms of how well we meet our basic needs. But most of us, most of the time, do respond to the promptings of our biological needs. You know, hunger and thirst and the need for maintaining our body temperatures, which may mean heating oil in the winter months, health care and on and on. When we get sick, we will spend money on what's needed to get well, if we have the money. So our choices are not totally unrelated to the promptings of human nature, if you will. But there are many, many examples of people who, for whatever reason, don't do a very good job of that. Sleep is probably a nice example of that, because we have a lot of freedom of choice in terms of whether or not we get an adequate sleep. There's a lot of research that shows that we really do need, most of us, about 8 hours a night. The average in the United States is about 6.9 hours per night.
Peter, I'm going to jump in right here and take a break because we need to take a quick station break. We'll return to this point in just a minute.
Okay.
My guest this hour is Peter Corning, director of the Institute for the Study of Complex Systems and a former writer for Newsweek. His new book is called The Fair Society, The Science of Human Nature and the Pursuit of Social Justice. If you want to join the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Peter Corning is here. He's director of the Institute for the Study of Complex Systems and author of the new book, The Fair Society, The Science of Human Nature and the Pursuit of Social Justice. And Peter, before the break, you were talking about this question of our choices and our personal responsibility.
Yes. Yeah, if I can, I'd like to pick up on that. Another good example of where we often make choices that are not good for our meeting our basic needs and for our health is exercise. A lot of evidence now suggests that we need exercise in order to maintain a healthy physical condition. Some of the experts recommend as much as 30 minutes a day of walking or the equivalent, or about 150 minutes a week. What that means is that only about 5 or 6% of the population are actually achieving that level. Most of us are falling short in one way or another. And then diet, of course, is another good example of where we often don't eat things that are really healthy for us. We make choices based on taste and preferences, to use the economist's term. Or gambling. People gambling away money that is needed for that prescription at the drugstore. So it is certainly true that our choices often, that we have to be responsible for the choices we make in terms of meeting our basic needs. But on the other hand, income is vitally important, and with the current minimum wage of a little over $7 an hour, this is a good example of how we do an inadequate job of providing enough income for people to be able to make the right choices. There's a lot of research that suggests that minimum wage is about half of what is really required for an adequate standard of living these days. In other words, it really ought to be the minimum wage ought to be about $15 an hour, with some variations in different parts of the country. But that's a pretty good average number, and most of the people in the working class these days, blue collar jobs and so on, don't make anywhere near that. So we are falling short in terms of providing the wherewithal to make those choices.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the line to Matthew in Dallas. Hey, Matthew.
Hi.
Hi.
Sorry, you caught me in the yard.
That's okay.
But I've been loving having y'all out there. So I just want to say, this goes to mobility, to moving through kind of up in our society, because I know my family, we kind of started dirt poor, and my mom grew up in trailers and all that, and then she got me through college, and now we're living in apartments and moving our way up. And I just have a question about the recession in general, and I know that it's put my family in a place where we've really taken a step back and looked at what our bills are. I mean, we've saved hundreds and hundreds of dollars just by being a little bit smarter. And I'm wondering what role these kinds of, economic shocks play in, social mobility upward. Because, I don't think we'd be anywhere if we weren't saving that $1,500 a month that we saved just by being a little smarter.
What do you think, Peter?
We've been living in an economic bubble, one economic bubble after another for the last 25 years. And what that has done is it has artificially inflated our paper wealth or our real estate wealth, and stocks and bonds and other forms of investments and savings for many years. And we haven't had a recession like the one we are really still involved in. We haven't really recovered from it. Parts of the economy have, and other parts have not. And so this is the first really serious economic shock since the Great Depression in the 1930s. And what it has done, it has wiped out trillions of dollars of savings. Baby boomers who are getting ready to retire with the equity in their homes have seen their home prices drop by 30% or 40% in even parts of the country like mine, where the recession has been somewhat milder than it has been in others, like in the Midwest. That and, of course, the meltdown in the stock market meant a lot of savings and stocks were lost. Some of that is recovered, but not all by any means. And some of the wealth that was lost will never, return. So an economic shock like the one we have gone through has, even with the most prudent kind of savings programs, or investing in real estate, which was supposed to be a good investment, have turned sour, and a great many people are struggling now on a much lower standard of living, with much less savings for retirement than they had before. And there is the conventional wisdom out there in the real estate business. I have a couple of friends who are involved in it now, is that they think it's going to take 10 years before we're going to see any significant appreciation in home prices again, and that in fact prices may continue to be pushed downward for the next little while, a year or two perhaps, because there's a flood of homes that didn't get put on the market in the last 2 years when things were very bad, and now they're suddenly coming on the market, and that's going to mean that the supply of homes for sale is going to outrun the demand by a long shot. and that's going to depress prices. So the answer, the short answer to your question is that yes, our mobility in society is going to be severely constrained by the fact that we no longer have the wealth that we did only a few years ago, but a lot of that was paper wealth.
I want to ask you about this. There are plenty of wealthy people out there who recognize this need for reciprocity and do, in fact, give back in large amounts to the community.
Absolutely.
But they want to make choices about where that money goes. Mm-hmm. Would this, if we were to move to a system like this, would they be limited and sort of give back the money with higher taxes or with sort of different requirements for them through the government that they would otherwise maybe allocate to the causes that they believe in?
Mm-hmm. Well, it's very true, and I think it's important to emphasize that there are many wealthy people in our society who do have a sense of reciprocity and wanting to give back and do contribute voluntarily to many, many worthy causes. The Gates Foundation, Bill and Melinda Gates, is probably the premier example, and Warren Buffett, who's put his money into their pot and let them use it, is another prime example of a responsible and very wealthy individual or family doing their fair share. But there, it's equally true that many wealthy people spend vast amounts on mega yachts that cost many millions of dollars, spend a relatively small share of their income on a charity, and that charity may be very self-serving. It may be something that they put their name on, and it is of marginal value to society, or maybe one more building on a college campus that is not really necessary, but it has their name on a plaque on the door. So not all private charity is well used, and it's not necessarily commensurate with what would be a fair share of their fortune as a give back to society. So it's a very much a mixed picture. But to get to the main point, if some of our needs as a society are not being met by private charity, then sometimes government has to supplement that. And the Social Security system is probably a prime example of that. Private charity would be unlikely to provide pensions for most people voluntarily. But a contributory system where we all pay taxes into the system and then we all get benefits from it, and where the administrative costs are very low, 2-3% of what we contribute, is an efficient way to achieve a social goal where everybody is asked to pay a fair share rather than leaving it to free choice.
So is it easier to, let's assume for the sake of argument that we chose to address this, is it easier to address it on a regional or national basis than it is on a global scale?
Oh, wow. It really kind of depends. Clearly, healthcare is something that is a personal individual matter, and the range of how wide you draw the circle in terms of what's an interdependent system kind of depends. Viruses that can cause illness travel globally. On the other hand, local factories that produce toxic air pollution is very local and a problem that should be dealt with locally. So it really kind of depends on what the individual source is of a need or a threat. Health being the perfect example of that. As for the general way of dealing with the healthcare costs. Gosh, there are arguments on both sides. Individual states might very well produce effective healthcare systems. Massachusetts has one, thanks to former Governor Mitt Romney, who now seems gun shy about taking credit for it. So individual states can do something like that for their members, but there are other states that don't have the means to do that, and or are unwilling to do that. And so we could end up with a patchwork where if you moved from Massachusetts to, I don't want to slur any other state, but some poor southern state, perhaps you would lose a health insurance system. And so that would be a deterrent to mobility, and we've been talking a lot these days about job mobility, wanting people to be able to move where the jobs are, and there are a lot of deterrents to that. Now, why add another deterrent by making it undesirable to move because you can't get health care benefits?
So we just have about a minute left. Talk about the balance if we were to try to strive toward a more fair society, the balance between the efforts of government and the private sector and the not-for-profit sector.
I think the answer is all of the above. Mm-hmm. There is no way that I think we can solve, that government can solve all these problems, certainly. That's very clear. And in some ways, we have a dysfunctional government that needs reform. There's no assurance that government can do the job. On the other hand, charity can't do the job. There are limits to what resources are available to meet our social needs in this society. And on the other hand, the private sector often has, in the past, come up with resourceful ways of solving our social and economic problems, inventions that benefit us all. So we wouldn't want to deter entrepreneurship and economic development. That would be a serious mistake for the future. A lot of our progress has been the result of the achievements of our capitalist system. So,
Peter Corning, I'm afraid we're out of time. Peter Corning is director of the Institute for the Study of Complex Systems. His new book is The Fair Society, The Science of Human Nature and the Pursuit of Social Justice. Peter, thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.